This holiday, deck their countertops with peppermint white chocolate mochas, gingerbread lattes, and pumpkin cream cold brews. Ninja Luxe Cafe is the ultimate gift. It's the number one best-selling espresso machine in the U.S., perfect for the coffee lovers in your life. If they can dream it, they can brew it. No skills needed. Espresso balanced. Drip coffee, rich. Cold brew in a flash. Hands-free, silky microfoam. Dairy or plant-based milks. Bring joy into their holiday and every day after with Ninja Luxe Cafe. Shop now.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
Yes, that's right. We've staggered out of the graveyard, but the nightmare is far from over. Here at Silver Screen, spooky season continues, and so does our very special crossover event, reviewing George A. Romero's Living Dead trilogy. Last time on Cinema Classics, we tackled the black and white terror of 1968's Night of the Living Dead. This week, we're moving a decade forward to a world that's falling apart, where the dead walk in broad daylight. And survival might just mean following the evidence of How I Met Your Mother's Robin Sparkles. Let's go to the mall, everybody. There's a reference for you. I am your host, Mike Wilson, as usual. I'm back again with my partner in zombie fighting crime, DK. Welcome. Yeah, do wake up, DK. This is just what you do every episode. People think it's zombie related, but this is just what you sound like every time we try to get your attention.
It's the whiskey, dude.
You said it. No, looking forward to talking about this one. So we've got lots of information coming up, and we'll wait and see what everyone's thoughts are. But still shambling along with us from last time is our queen of sci-fi turned scream queen for the season, Nita.
Hello, everyone. Thank you for having me here.
You're very welcome. Thanks for coming back. And I know you love all things zombie, so we're expecting some good input from you.
That's why you're on this podcast, mate.
You said it. I mean, if anybody sounds half dead, it's going to be us.
No.
And we do actually have a newcomer to our trilogy of terror here. Joining us for the first time, a bit of a rookie, but wanting to prove that he's got the guts for Romero's gory playground. Please welcome Josh. Welcome, buddy.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. I'm looking forward to having some new input here. We were supposed to have you with us last week, but I think wires got crossed and zombies attacked and we all just dived into the nearest house.
Pretty much.
Yeah. So now looking forward to it. We've got a full house or a full mall to record this one. So grab your trolley, watch those escalators, and remember, they don't want us. They want the place. Welcome to the iconic blood-soaked satirical sequel. Try saying that 10 times fast. Dawn of the Dead, 1978. Woo! We all ready to talk this one?
Yes, let's do this.
Very much.
Let's roll.
Yeah. We normally start with the behind the scenes section, but for the purposes of the behind the scenes for this one, I'm basically going to talk more about one particular thing, which is the alternate versions of this movie, because there are several. The one that I watched was on 4K, take a drink, and the box set contains three discs, each with a different version of the movie and then a disc of features. So I'm going to go into what they are, and I can confirm that I watched something other than the theatrical version, which I'll let you know and can tell you what the differences are since I watched a bit different. So anyway, there are three main versions of the film. The US theatrical version, which George A. Romero considers his definitive cut of the film, it was the version released in American theaters in 1979 and contains a mix of both Goblin's soundtrack and several library tracks. Dario Argento's cut was released in Italy under the title, I presume it's pronounced Zombie, but it's spelled Zombie without the E. This is also known as the European version and runs around 118 minutes. It removes several scenes, mostly anything humorous, emphasizing the horror and the action, and has more extensive use of the goblin music on the soundtrack. The extended version, or the Cannes Film Festival version, is the one that I watched this time and can review. That runs 139 minutes, and it's erroneously been called the director's cut when released on some other formats, but it's not technically Romero's preferred cut. It is just extended. It was assembled to premiere at the 1978 Cannes Film Festival, and it's something of a work print. It contains many extended scenes, and the soundtrack is almost entirely library tracks, although, frustratingly, the goblins, as they are miscredited, are still credited at the start of the movie, so that's bizarre. All three versions have been made available on Anchor Bay's DVD box set, the Japanese Happynet Stingray Blu-ray box set, and Arrow's UK Blu-ray box set. An extended version has found its way onto file-sharing sites called the Extended Mall Hours Cut, which combines footage from all three major versions into a 155-minute cut of the film, which I didn't know about till now, so don't ask, I haven't watched that. So, yeah, obviously, we're going to be... I'm assuming that the majority of us here have probably watched the theatrical, the original main release version.
Yeah.
The version that I have, I was actually just looking at the DVD, is 127 minutes.
That's the original theatrical release. Yeah. Yeah, that's cool. And Nita, did you watch this theatrical version? Do you know?
I think so. Because I when I rewatched it this time for here, I watched it on YouTube.
Okay.
And it's about almost 3 hours, so I think it is.
Okay. Wow. That might be the extended.
2.5 hours. Yeah, I think it might be extended Blu-ray type version. Yeah.
That sounds more like the Cannes cut. That was the one that I watched, which I think is just over 2 hours 20.
Yes. So yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, as I say, I can tell you the differences because I have seen the theatrical many a time, and I thought for this time around, I want to watch one of the other two that I haven't seen, but I didn't want to watch the Argento cut because it removes things, and I'd rather watch a version that adds things in than miss anything or lose anything. So, but yeah, the reason that came about was basically because the film was produced with the Italian backing by Dario Argento, who, if you don't know, is a really famous Italian film director. He directs famously giallo horror movies. You may have heard of Suspiria or Deep Red or Tenebrae. His daughter actually stars in George Romero's Land of the Dead, Asia Argento. It's a weird sort of cyclical kind of thing. And yeah, as I said, the soundtrack on his version and half of the soundtrack on the theatrical version is by a band called Goblin, who work on basically all of Argento's movies in Italy. They're an Italian sort of, I guess, heavy metal rock kind of band. But yeah, for some reason, they are credited in all of the Dawn of the Dead as the Goblins, which isn't their name, annoyingly. So, yeah. So that's all I have anyway for the behind the scenes. Did you have anything for this, Dicky, or was it more sort of when we get to the section?
Mine's section-based, so...
Okay, so nothing you wanted to start us with here?
Yeah, no, screw that.
Cool. Right, well, before we do jump into the sections, I always like to start the same way on these things, which is to ask you if you can remember the very first time that you saw this movie and what your initial impressions, as spoiler-free as possible, about your thoughts were of the film. So because you're a newcomer, Josh, could you recall the first time you watched Dawn of the Dead? Was it in the cinema or on video or something? And what was your initial impression when you saw it that first time?
So what got me to see Dawn of the Dead for the first time is, and I know that I said earlier that Dawn, the original Dawn, was the first zombie film that I had seen. Because the first one, what got me interested in it was 28 Days Later. I personally don't consider 28 Days Later a zombie film because they're not dead. And then I started reading into, you know, George Romero and a bunch of his stuff. And I had come across the DVD of Dawn of the Dead at Best Buy at the time when I was working. I was like, you know, I'm going to buy this. And I think I was 17 or 18 at the time. And I brought it home, I watched it, and I thought that it was a great film. And then after that, I just went back and watched the rest of Romero's films.
Ah, cool. Awesome. And how about you, Nita? You're a big zombie fan, so I'm guessing you probably were a fan before you came to this.
Yes, absolutely. I'm a big fat zombie fan. But I remember watching this particular 1978 version when they had given it on television, because I was and it had been a few years already that had passed, I think I wouldn't have been, my mother wouldn't have allowed me to go watch that. I was too young when this came out to have watched it in the theater, but I had watched that black and white zombie one first. And this one, you know, it was colored and it was more familiar because it was more, you know, modern, to closer to modern than the other one was for me at the time. I think it was like maybe early 80s. And this was it was something that I enjoyed watching. But I think that as I watched more zombie stuff and read more zombie stuff, this, I got a little questions about it.
Okay. All right. Well, I'm sure we'll
get into it. But I do want to say, I do agree, 28 Days Later, fantastic movie. But
oh yeah,
I question its zombie lore because I don't think that it's zombie. But they're not dead. And yeah, to qualify to be a zombie, you must first be dead.
I can definitely agree with
that. I'm a purist when it comes to zombies.
Weirdly enough, this argument came up when I was at university because one of my colleagues did his dissertation on zombie films, and he was told allowed to include the Evil Dead films because they're not zombies; it's demonic possession. And I was like, "That's technically correct."
They were right.
Anyway,
there's nothing wrong with any of these films; they just don't belong in the genre. And in the strictly
speaking, yeah.
Exactly.
So how about you, DK, then? What was the first time you came across Dawn of the Dead?
I think it was several years after I watched Day, and they showed it on Channel 4.
Oh, yeah, you mentioned you went backwards.
I did Benjamin Button these bitches. It was a few years after I saw Day. I think they were showing it late one night, and I think it was the first time they made a big kind of hoopla about it. The first time they showed it on British TV on Channel 4, so I watched it on that.
Awesome. I think we probably watched the same thing, because I know that it was definitely classed as a video nasty during that whole annoying flipping censorship panic of the like 80s and stuff. So it was always one of those that was like, dude, it's terrible, you can't watch it. And so we couldn't ever get around to seeing it or whatever for the longest time. Not that I would have been fussed, because I wasn't really into horror films until I got to be, you know, post-puberty, shall we say. I remember that being a big deal, that it was like, wow, the former video nasty to be aired on TV. I'm fairly certain, if I remember correctly, that it was heavily cut to have aired on Channel 4. Because,
yes. Yeah, it was, I believe, yeah.
Because I do remember when I saw the actual sort of Blu-ray, as it were, years later, I was like, well, there's way more here than what Channel 4 actually showed. But that was the first time I saw it. And then I think I bought the Blu-ray because of the Zack Snyder version, and I wanted to have the original and see what that was about first. So I definitely watched it on there. And then, as I said, I since upgraded to the 4K box set, which highly recommended, because, like I said, three versions of the movie plus a wealth of features and everything. So
it's expensive. I've actually tried to find the 4K Blu-ray version here, but it's not available. Like, because I would love to have it, but I can't find it anywhere. It's out of stock on every website that I've checked.
That's rough. I was quite pleased to have it. I got it when it was on sale, so it wasn't even that expensive. I think it was about £40 in English money, which, you know, for what it is, it's not bad at all. It's a comprehensive box set, you know, three versions of the movie. So what can you say?
Yeah, that's not bad at all.
Yeah, and DK, that's the version you've got, but I presume you must have the Blu-ray version, though, yeah?
Yes.
Yeah, so now what we'll do now is that's getting it covered, what everybody's first experiences were. So we'll break the film review down the way we always do, starting with the writing and plot would be the first category. You'll hear the rest as we go on. So, DK, do you have anything on the writing and the plot you want to start us with?
I do, yes. the idea for the film came about when George A. Romero was invited by his friend Mark Mason to a backstage tour of the recently completed Monroeville Mall. Mason noted to Romero that this would be the perfect place to hole up in during an emergency, planting the seed with Romero for his next film. Now, Romero described this as the balance point in the series, when the number of humans versus the number of zombies was roughly equal. As you mentioned, financing had ground to a halt when Dario Argento got wind of the project. Argento was a huge fan of Night of the Living Dead and was able to secure international rights for the sequel, thereby guaranteeing its budget. Now, in the originally scripted ending, Peter was supposed to shoot himself in the head while Fran commits suicide by sticking her head up into the blades of the helicopter. Romero, however, had fallen in love with the characters over the course of the movie and felt that after the horrors they had endured, this conclusion would be too depressing. He also realised that they made the film too much like a comic book, too funny to have it end horrifically. Partially on the suggestion of his future wife, Christine Forrest, he decided to give Peter and Fran a little bit of hope, with Savini remembering that George announced during production that they were going to have an up ending. Yet there's a dispute over the film's alternate ending where some crew members, such as Tom Savini and Tasso Enstavrakis, maintained that it was filmed, while Romero used to be adamant that it wasn't. However, in the documentary, Document of the Dead from 1980, which was shot during the making of this film and is included on some DVD copies, Romero clearly states to Frunkis while walking around the mall set that they did indeed film the alternate ending, although he never filmed the effect shots. Galen Ross already had a head mold made for Fran's death scene, and Savini did not want to see it go to waste, so he dressed it up as a bearded black man, and that is the head that is blown off by a shotgun blast at the beginning of the film. And that's what
yeah,
I've got.
Sorry, is that what you've had? Yeah. Okay, cool. Yeah, I read that somewhere as well, and if you look on the Wikipedia page, you can see the picture of that dummy that whose head blows up early on. It's wild. But yeah, they also point out there are, you can kind of see that the build-up to that original ending is there, because you can see Peter, you know, contemplate suicide and put the gun in his mouth and everything. And as you say, there's a lot of hints about the helicopter and the rotor blades and even the famous chopper zombie, whose head kind of gets cut off and then reappears later with his head like the top of an egg, just sliced immediately off. So yeah, it's kind of, there's hints there, but I get what you're saying is, like you said, tonally, I don't know if it would have necessarily fit that the nature of this film, because it does have a bit of that comedy edge to it. And but I was just relieved there were actual survivors this time after Night of the Living Dead, especially that the black guy survived, to be frank.
Yeah.
I did read though, however, that in the alternate ending, after, you know, they'd committed the deed and both killed themselves, the chopper would have apparently ran out of fuel after just a few like seconds, implying that they wouldn't have got very far if they had survived. So chances are they didn't anyway, if you want to look at it really negatively. So that sucks. But I guess, you know, we don't see them again, so you kind of have to assume that's what happened. So, going into the writing and the plot, then I have kind of, there's so much that this film kind of comments on, and I've made kind of notes of all of it, and I'll kind of throw it to you guys after I've kind of went through it. So first of all, it's been said that it's a social commentary on capitalism and consumerism. Obviously, that makes sense. It takes place in a mall. It's a consumerism critique because the mall is both a sanctuary and a trap. The idea of the zombies as mindless consumers echoes the 70s anxieties about capitalism. Mm. And as I mentioned, the idea that, you know, that zombies still have some kind of semblance of sense memory, and all of these people are just aimlessly wandering to the mall just because it's behavior they were used to, I think is kind of its own satirical comment. It also sort of speaks to the breakdown of social order versus the attempt to build a new mini civilization. And with that, the kind of futility of trying to survive and rebuild, I guess, in some ways. Maybe that's a little bit bleaker than the film wants to be, but I think it is there. Regarding race and gender in the film, I think, like I said, at least the black man is arguably the lead and survives. And Fran is one of Romero's first proactive female leads. So, yeah, you've kind of got that as well. In terms of the mythology, it also helped define the zombie genre. The idea of zombies, herds acting together, the idea that a bite will infect you and you will be reborn as one of them, the survivalist settings. Yeah, and it set the template for the idea of a zombie as a metaphor beyond just the kind of Cold War or racial allegory of Night of the Living Dead, escalating from the farmhouse to a mall, which is kind of a whole mini society. And yeah, that's the kind of, the satire is mirroring consumer culture, as I said. So, any thoughts from any of you guys on any of those things? Did you, I assume we picked up on most, if not all of those. And again, I'll come to you first and ask about that, Josh.
Yeah, I remember when I first watched it and I looked into it, and the consumerism allegory was definitely there. Especially for the time period in which the film takes place in the 70s, they had just started coming out with these big indoor shopping malls. And actually, one of the lines in the film that sticks in my head is when they're right before they land at the mall, they actually say, "Oh, look, there's one of those new indoor shopping malls." And it's definitely allegorical for American consumerism at the time, because and even now it's still relevant, because it's just buy, and talking about like with Fran, I was very happy to see that she was a stronger character than Barbara from Night of the Living Dead. Very happy to see that with Fran, and I do agree with you that the fact that the black guy survives was great. And the line of "No more room in hell," that's one of my favorite lines in all of cinema, and I was glad that they actually included that in the 2004 remake.
Yes, with a little cameo as well by Ken Corey.
Yeah, exactly.
That was an epic line, though. That was the best line.
It was really good.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Fantastic. Anyway, moving to you, Nita, what do you think about the things I mentioned? Did you pick up on anything? And what kind of stood out the most about what the film's trying to say, maybe? And what did you appreciate the most?
Well, I want to start with what I appreciate the most. And I love the fact that they continued that theme of the black, the African-American, the black man being in charge, being the survivor, being someone who was pivotal in the film, right? And that representation was good. And I did see some definite changes. And it can be debated as to whether or not the female representation was adequate, but it was for the times. We got to remember when the film was made, exactly, how women were viewed in this time. And I think that considering that it was not even the 80s yet, it was very progressive how they viewed women. There were moments in the film where I said, really, what the heck is she doing? You know, that moment I think they were like out in the open and he's fighting and the zombie, and she's standing there and this other zombie is coming. And I'm thinking, would you give him the sledgehammer? Like, participate. considering the times, it was exactly what she was be expected to do. I think that it was really something that I think that, you know, zombie lore, sci-fi is always so progressive and ahead of its time. And I think the message is definitely clear, you know, it's about survival. And I think it's about how people behave when given worst case scenario surroundings and the choices they make. Yeah.
No, I'm with you. I'm with you that there was still kind of obviously work to be done, but I do think it's very important that you have that scene where Fran basically says, "Look, I'm not going to be your den mother just because I'm a woman, and please, I want to be consulted on. You know, if there's a decision to be made, there's four people here. I want to be consulted as well." So that's actually, as you said, it's very, very progressive, especially for 70
years. I absolutely love that kind of mall scene too. And I don't know if we're going to get into, and you let me know, Michael, the conversation of the actual zombie behavior, because, I have some thoughts. And if we're doing it later, I'll hold off. Yeah, absolutely.
No, if you want to get into it, just by all means, get into it.
Okay, because, I've watched a lot of zombie, and I read zombie in comics, and these are the slowest zombies ever. Like,
yeah, obviously.
They're just slow. And they're bluish gray. Like, what was that about? But think that
there's a reason for that. But I assume TK has that in the thing.
As the movies progress, they get better at these things, better at emulating what they would imagine zombie behavior would be, what they would look like. And I think that that's great that you see that progression when you see all these movies, you know, in that sequence. But I find it very interesting because at some points I'm going, why are you running? You could go back and forth like 20 times before that zombie comes to you. Like, because you see the zombies in more current films and current movies, and they are fast. And they are super fast.
I'm not a fan of the fast zombie cruise thing. Yeah.
I mean, I hate running, so yeah, I don't like fast zombies.
And I want to comment on that too, because when I first watched, I did notice how slow and lumbering they were. Mm-hmm. And you're right. In later films, they do pick up speed. I don't like the ones that run, but I like the ones that lumber a little faster. These are just you're still going to be there. I'll get there in 10 minutes. Then I'm going to bite your face off.
Exactly.
You see that, like you said, you see them evolve, and that's one of the beauties of Romero's films. They evolve as they go.
Yeah. And I always like the fact that he has this diversity in the group, that main group that's surviving, where there's that female element and that minority element. And then you have that soldier element. You've got all the things that will help a group survive. And they put it together in a subtle way that if you're not paying close attention, you're going to miss that. And I like that about that film. I love that he does this in this film.
Yeah, I have to say I had a momentary kind of a depression moment at the start of the movie where I'll explain what I mean, because when the kind of SWAT team are all gathering to kind of raid the apartment complex, and you get that one really annoying, like incredibly racist cop who's like, oh, it's ridiculous. And he says, it's so like on the nose for the moment in the UK, that he just says like, it's just not fair. They're putting these guys up in luxury hotels. They're better than what I've got and everything. And I'm like, that is literally the same argument that I've heard from like family over the last few weeks. And it's been kind of parroted on the TV about like, oh, immigrants being put up in luxury hotels and stuff. And I'm like, it's been 30 years and they're still using the same arguments, and idiots are still falling for it.
And it's funny you say that, because I also got into an argument with a family member who said the exact same thing here about a week ago.
Yeah, it's so annoying, because it's clearly propaganda. And like you said, the fact that it's in a film in 78 and it's the same crap just goes to show, you know, it's sad that it's still effective, to be honest. You know what I mean? But anyway, yeah, that was the moment I was like, oh, man, that's a bit of social satire I didn't need, that was a bit too on the nose for me at the very start. And it's not even about the zombies, like I said, because a lot of this film does kind of touch on, yeah, the zombies are bad, but people are equally, if not worse. You know. So, anyway, DK, I haven't come to you yet. What do you think about the kind of what the film says allegorically? And is there anything that stands out sort of stronger for you and that you appreciate the best here?
I do like the allegory about it, consumerism, that kind of thing. And I will point out, though, with regards to Fran, I'd save this for the casting, but I might as well bring it up. Galen Ross refused to scream. She felt that Fran was a strong female character, and if she screamed, the strength would be lost. She told this to George Romero once when he told her to scream, and he never asked her again after that one.
That's pretty cool to know as well. That makes sense.
Yeah, she also
that's very interesting.
Yeah, she also had the idea that she did not want to not know how to handle a weapon. So that's why you've got the whole teaching thing in, because she said to Romero that, she wouldn't just stand there and let everything happen around her. She wanted to be a proactive.
That's awesome. Yeah. I mean, I know she does kind of take on the nursing role in the end, but I don't think it's kind of a return to those roles. And I do like that she kind of, the plot has her say that she wants to learn how to fly the helicopter, just in case she's the only survivor, you know, because that's pragmatic thinking, really, you know. And she kind of seems like the last one to be seduced, as it were, by them all as well, and the idea that it could be somewhere to stay in. She's like, well, you know, but I mean, she does get there when you have the makeover sequence and everything at the end. I think that's when it ultimately kind of gets to her as well. But it's telling that she's the one for a lot of the time. That's like, you've just been seduced by the bright lights and everything, you know, all of the consumerism aspects, and it's not going to be a safe haven. So, but, anyway, did you pick up on that thing as well, did you?
What, the makeup thing?
Yeah, well, just that she was like the last holdout that didn't get, like I said, brainwashed, as it were, into thinking the mall was a worthwhile place to stay.
Yeah, I do like that, because normally, and this is why I like, obviously we're not talking about, Barbara in the first one, but Romero since then, he gives his female characters a sense of agency that even these days you wouldn't necessarily see in other horror movies.
Oh, no, that's it.
you know, and I think this is pretty much where it began. And yeah, I like that he makes them actual, he makes minorities and he makes women feel like actual characters, and they're not just decoration. I mean, he did, you know, I mean, obviously he did good with Ben in Night of the Living Dead, but he progresses it here with Peter. And, I know I'm falling back on what I said last week, but for his attitudes and for the way he actually advocates these kind of progressive views, I think Romero is a very underrated director. Everybody looks at him as, you know, he's just pure schlock, but he was doing what a lot of directors are only just discovering, and he was doing it, you know, 50 years ago.
Go ahead.
Sorry about that. I didn't mean to cut you off. No, Romero is an amazing director. One of my all-time favorites, and he's also a phenomenal writer too. The way he writes a lot of his characters is great. So,
yeah, I was going to say exactly that. Actually, I was just going to say, I piggyback on that and add that I think he's a great writer, and this film is saying so much and doing so much if you actually look just under the surface and beyond the kind of schlock aspects, as you said. Even if there are bits that you don't necessarily like, I think you can't deny that there's commentary going on throughout this. And I have to say, while we're on the subject of Fran, I just have to quickly add, you can definitely tell it's a 1970s movie, because there's a whole plot about her being pregnant, and then she immediately just resumes chain smoking.
Well, that and the bell bottoms really give it away. Bell bottoms.
Bell bottoms are coming back into style these days.
Oh God, no, please!
I cannot believe it. That was the worst fashion faux pas of the 70s, but they're coming back into style. So,
Yeah, that's fair enough. Bring on the zombies, maybe, but no, that's fine. We'll live with the bell bottoms. So, the next question I had actually ties into a conversation I had off air with DK, because the question that I kind of came up with was, how does Romero balance the nihilism with kind of the more absurd elements? And DK, I remember having a conversation where you basically said you didn't feel like it did, but you kind of lose the film when the bikers are introduced.
Yeah,
and a little bit comedic.
When the bikers show up, it gets a little too out there for me. Up until that point, I'm completely sold on the movie. I love the tone. I think it's perfect. But when the bikers come in, you know, and maybe that's just a social thing, because, you know, when people show up at my door, I fucking hate it. But it's the fact that it just goes a little over the top. I can understand the bikers coming in. I can understand and cause it. Obviously, you know, it helps turn Flyboy into a zombie. So I get the need. They have to address it during the film. But I'm sure you all three like it. I'm going to get hung for it. Not really bothered about seeing a fucking custard pie fight with zombies. It's like watching an old episode of Tiz Was. You'll know what that is, mate.
Yeah, I hear what you're saying. I don't mind. I mean, like, even though it goes a bit far, I think, like I said, it is, by its nature, it's that kind of movie. It equally goes as far with the kind of the headshots and the violence and the Savini kind of, you know, makeup effects and things. So I just see it as kind of the flip side of that.
I can't take the fact that, you know, you have all these people throughout the movie and they're trying their best to get away from the zombies. And then in this scene, you see a guy, you know, oh God, I'm surrounded by zombies. Better take my blood pressure for just a bit of comic relief. It doesn't ring true for me.
And actually, DK, I do agree with you on
that. Yeah, again, I don't mind it too.
The biker scene was just, it felt too forced, in my opinion.
Yeah.
It felt like there had to be some type of conflict, so that was put in there. And I would get, you know, if there were a few people that invaded the mall. But, and like you said, if I'm watching something that's horror, I don't like a lot of comedy in it. The pie fight, that could have been completely cut, and I'm 100% okay with that.
The way that I saw that whole biker scenario going on is, I felt like if this movie would have said, oh, the zombie apocalypse has been going on for years, then I can see that outlaw mentality taking over. But it was just too soon for me. Like, I didn't think it was Yeah,
100%.
Yeah,
I can kind of defend it because, like I said, for me, it just it's the flip side of the extreme nature of the horror of the movie, and I get that, you know, it's also, you know, it kind of feeds into the satirical edge in some ways, and for me, it kind of also it leads into kind of my next question actually, which was just, is it actually the zombies or the humans that you think the film is presenting as the bigger threat? And I think it's something that The Walking Dead took and ran with, you know, many decades later, the idea that, you know, zombies are an issue, humans are far worse. And I think that's the point. And that's kind of where does the biker gang come in, because it's not the zombies that are ultimately responsible for finishing them off. It's because they invade the mall and, you know, basically screw things over for everyone.
Element is excellent. That element of showing you that no matter how bad things are in the world, we as humans are truly the danger. We're the ones causing the real problem. That mentality, it fits the narrative of in the zombie lore. I just felt like they could have gone a different way about it, because I felt like the biker gang was way too outlaw type guys.
It's interesting you say that, because I mentioned to GK when you mentioned about the biker thing, I says that's the interesting thing is, when you watch the extended can cut, the bikers don't actually, it feels weird because they don't appear till like the last 20 minutes of a 2-hour 20 version of the movie. And so I actually think it benefits from that, because you have got all that space in between where, I mean, months have passed, basically so much has happened and the characters have all lived their lives in the mall, so it gives you that bit of extra breathing space. And I don't know if I love the idea of it with, you know, being that long, but I think it, by the time it comes, it's necessary, because there hasn't been any horror or action or anything for so long in this version of the film. It's all
they were getting complacent and, yes, it was very, they were being too safe in their environment. I agree with that. They were, because they have been there for a while. So and one thing you learn in watching zombie apocalypse movies and the zombie lore is, don't get comfortable.
Yeah, exactly.
Because there is no safe haven. Don't get comfortable.
Exactly. I completely agree with that. Never, ever get comfortable in the zombie apocalypse.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But there's so much cool. I mean, I really love the character drama that happens when, you know, there's not horror going on outside, but it also feels like not a horror movie, because they're starting to get into like domestic arguments about, like, you know, there's a full-on argument, and I can't remember if it's in the theatrical version, where Fran and her boyfriend like argue over whether or not to keep the TV on just in case the stations come back. And like, she gets up from the dinner table, turns the TV off. He gets up, turns it back on and stares at her like, what are you going to do about it? I was like, this is really kind of cool stuff, but it's got nothing to do with the zombies. It's just like, you know, society has collapsed and we're all falling with it kind of thing. But that's the idea. I think it's saying like, there's no such thing as a safe haven, even if you think you're safe. You know, our worst natures are going to get the better of us, and there's always going to be something, you know? So, it's nihilistic, but...
Yeah, and that going back to no safe haven, going back to humanity being its own worst enemy, that's the bottom line of the whole thing, is...
Oh, completely, yeah.
No matter where you think you're safe, it is not the zombies you're going to have to worry about, because if you're safe, someone else is going to want to take that safe space from you.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And one thing, as a female viewer, I have to say this, that the relationship that the original team that went into the mall created with one another and made her feel safe, that's a huge deal. Like, I can't even put it into words, as a woman, to be in a space where there's so many men and feel that you're okay, that you don't have to be on guard, that you don't have to be in your fight or flight mentality. And I like that they made her feel safe, but I like that they made her stronger, because she wanted to be a part of that fight and not be the damsel in distress. And I think that was important for women to see then, and I think it's still important for women to see now, that it's not all men. We just don't know who it is. So we are always on fight or flight mode until we know. And I just love that environment that they created for her. safe haven, because when you're dealing with something like a zombie apocalypse where there's government collapse, behaviors are going to come out of the woodwork that you may have not ever encountered. And it's something that's in the forefront of every woman's mind. Am I in an environment where I have to be concerned? It always happens. And I love the fact that they made that safe for her, you know?
And she made it, as kind of we were saying, she made it safe for herself by saying, like, mm-hmm. if you guys leave me a weapon, I can handle myself, you know? So
exactly.
I feel like when the film came out in the 70s, that was a somewhat new thing, and I felt like, and I agree mm-hmm. with everybody that it was something that needed to be shown.
Yeah,
it needed to be shown that women can also be empowered and have mm-hmm. and do the same things that men can in certain situations.
Absolutely. Just to kind of emphasize my point that I was saying, though, is that one of the things that I did like about the extended version, like I said, is that it also gets more into the idea that even if you think you're safe and comfortable, eventually it's going to, because you're so trapped in this environment, you know, they, like I said, they kind of, their relationships break down, and so Fran and Stephen find themselves drifting apart. There's a scene of them in bed together, but miles apart from each other. And like I said, that little domestic argument, and even like he even proposes to her and she refuses because she says it wouldn't be real, which I think is quite telling. Like it wouldn't be a real marriage because the whole world's kind of collapsed anyway. And she, you know, she would want to be part of society in that sense. So, yeah, anyway, so moving on from that to what I wanted to talk about next is the kind of character, the character arcs, as it were. So talking about, like, I love that they all have their own sort of methods of survival and their own fates, ultimately. So you've got Peter, the kind of pragmatic survivor at the end of the day, in this version anyway, you know, when he doesn't commit suicide at the end. We've got Roger's slow decline, the kind of the subplot about the infection, that he's, you know, he gets cocky and goes a little bit crazy, gets bitten, and then ultimately fades. And I think there's a tragedy in that. You know, Stephen and Flyboys, initially kind of being a little bit inept, and then eventually the kind of the utter sort of shock and tragedy when he is turned and becomes the zombie that, you know, breaches the safe haven, is just horrible. And like we already said, like Fran's evolution from starting off a little bit marginalized to being the essential decision maker, I love all of that. And do you guys do you see that, and is there anything else that you pick up on about the character arcs that you wanted to mention, Josh? Again, I may as well come to you next and ask about that.
I definitely, Romero's always really good about the story arcs with the characters that he makes. And I'm going to go back to, except for Barbara, I'm going to go back to that one. but just the way his character progression in most of his films is amazing. And just, and seeing the characters grow and progress and become something completely different than what they were when the film started, is just it's really great to see something like that on screen, because there's a lot of films these days where you don't see that character progression. The characters are just dull throughout the progress of the entire film, and it's just something that's lacking, I think, in a lot of modern cinema that Romero covered very well, not just in this film but in all of his his Dead series. So,
yeah, definitely. Yeah. And Nita, you've already mentioned basically that you probably respond more to Fran's character arc than anybody else's because of identifiable reasons, you know. So with that in mind, is there anything of the men's kind of character arcs that you appreciated the most or that affected you sort of stronger?
I did. I felt, you know, I forget his name, but he's the one, I call him the sharpshooter, because he got every shot, right?
Roger.
Yes, yeah. Roger, that's his name. I feel they started him off as this, you know, silent kind of gruffy kind of guy where he would just step in, boom, get the shot, let's move on kind of attitude without really saying it. Like, but I felt like he developed as the movie went and there was more of him being seen, more of who he was, his character, and he grew. I think that he kind of blossomed, and he was still that same rough kind of tough guy, but you saw the edges of who he was as a character. And I felt that progression as I saw the movie. And that was something that I appreciated, because they didn't keep him, and they could have most certainly kept him scruffy and silent and, you know, say nothing kind of moment. But they didn't. They allowed his character to kind of grow. And I feel like he helped the others that weren't trained the way he was to defend themselves and be a part of defending their kind of environment that they were creating there.
Yeah. Do you think that makes it all the more tragic then, when he kind of like his cockiness gets him bitten and you have to watch him?
Oh, sure.
You watch him slow fade, and it's kind of, it's not even a quick thing. It's like heartbreakingly, you know, and he has that whole conversation.
Yeah. But you see, I think that he needed that. I think his character needed that moment, because I think that that's solidified his growth in saying, I'm more than just this.
Yeah,
I have all of this to offer, and it's sad and tragic and beautiful.
What about you, DK? Character arc-wise, anything that sort of speaks to you more that we haven't talked about?
Well, I mean, he has just gone through Roger. Roger's my favorite character in this.
Okay.
Yeah, I do like that he switches, as Nita was saying, and you know, you develop some kind of empathy for him. So when he is eventually bitten, it breaks your heart. As you see it going on. I also like Stephen, Flyboy, simply because when you first start watching it, you don't see him interact that much other than with Fran. And he's acting all authoritative. Because
he starts as a bit of a dick, though, actually.
Yeah, he's flying the helicopter, and you think, well, I'm not going to like this character. This character's going to fuck everything up for everybody, especially, you know, when he tries shooting the zombie and Peter stood behind the zombie.
Yeah.
And you think, yeah, this isn't going to end well.
That's an important moment as well, yeah.
Yeah, he develops into a really good character. So again, when he does get turned, it's fucking heartbreaking.
Yeah.
But I have to say, Stephen MG, who did that portrayal of a zombie, second to none. I think that's one of the best portrayed zombies in the franchise.
Yes, hands down.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and when he turns to that false wall, and your stomach just dropped, and you just say, oh, Jesus. Yeah.
I remember the first time I saw it, I wasn't expecting him to come back, because, I mean, we'd seen the zombies, like, rip people apart and stuff, and they kind of all pile onto him in the lift, so I thought, oh, that's him dead, he's going to be in bits. And so when the kind of lift stops and he's still alive-ish, but he's like a zombie, I remember being so devastated and like, oh no.
Yeah, the zombies in that lift just weren't very hungry.
Clearly.
Yeah.
But then, as you said, like, he's been kind of a little bit awkward all through the movie, but the awkward physicality of like dragging your broken foot and slowly lumbering and like holding the gun the wrong way so it's just dangling off your hand kind of thing. It's just, it's all chef's kiss. It's little moments like the little things, you know.
I do wonder, and you know, shoot me down if you don't see it, but I do wonder if there was meant to be some kind of subtext between Roger and Peter. They seem to be very close at times, almost like a married couple. And I know they just meet in this film, but there seems to be kind of a closeness to them. And
I thought the implication was that they'd worked together as in the SWAT team before.
I know they'd worked together in the SWAT team, but they never really knew each other, if you know what I mean. And they get to know each other. But I just thought, is George hinting at, I could be just reading stuff into it that, you know, I see what I want to see, but I think it is George reading into it that there's more to this than just work colleagues or stuff. They do seem very close.
I see what you're saying, but I also personally think I read it more as a kind of, more of a protective kind of thing. Like, they're very just protective of each other as almost like weirdly fatherly towards each other. Like, they want to keep each other alive as yeah, I mean, there's a
fair
bond
enough
there, but
like I said, I mean, you know, it could just be what I took from it.
I mean, if you want to read it that way, it's definitely, I can see where you're coming from. Like you said, Peter's the one that carts him around when he's half dead and everything as well. So, yeah, he certainly is there for him. Anyway, yeah, cool. So we'll move on then, because, again, I don't want to take up too long because I've got so much to say about this film and could talk for hours, but don't want to. So, yeah, next thing we'll talk about will be the direction. And again, DK, I assume you have BTS section from this.
I do, yeah.
Bring it, DK, bring it.
Here I come, baby. right. According to Romero, in the voiceover narrative, the whole scene we were talking about earlier, the whole scene of Fran wearing the makeup and posing with the revolver, it was an improv from Galen Ross. And it almost landed on the cutting room floor, but they decided to leave it in at the last minute, showing how the survivors were starting to crack up, even with the standard of living that they got in the mall. Now, yeah. The film was intentionally more comedic than Night of the Living Dead, because Romero wanted it in the style of a comic book, to the point where a lot of the makeup crew, including Savini, did not like the blood. It was too thick, too fluorescent. And Romero said, no, that's how he wanted it, because he wanted that comic book feel. Mm-hmm. And yeah, shooting at the mall was suspended over the Christmas season because obviously it would have been too costly to remove and then later rehang all the seasonal decorations.
In terms of the directing, I just wanted to sort of mention a couple of things that I picked up on, which is I love the way that Romero uses the space of the mall so that it can be both like infinite or incredibly claustrophobic, depending on like scene to scene. And as you said, there's times when you're just like, well, these zombies are incredibly slow and there's barely any of them. It's fine. And then there's times that you're like, oh, this is, you're trapped and imprisoned here. I think, like I said, the pacing for me doesn't work as well in the extended can version. But I do think that the kind of what they call a deliberate middle section, the playing house in the mall thing, I think is necessary. It just doesn't necessarily have to run as long, because I think that is there to show you the idea that comfort can also be empty. You know, it's like I said earlier, you know, you can still also be miserable even if you are comfortable, so to speak, which I think again speaks to the idea of the mall, that we're all kind of seduced by this. And here are some things that can make you change your life and you'll be happy with this and that. And it's all kind of shallow at the end of the day. But to that regard, I also love that, you know, they're in the middle of this horrific zombie thing and you've still got the little mall announcements going off. That kind of did make me chuckle, that little bit of comedic satire, you know. Like, oh, but if you buy this now, you could get a free bag of candy or whatever. And, there's just something
wild about
that. It's interesting
that you mentioned, you know, the satire in the zombie horror. I'm not a huge fan of it, but because I think horror is horror, you know, but horror can be funny if done correctly. One thing I thought was hilarious is the stealing that went on when the bikers got into
the looting,
the mall. I can understand the jewelry, right? Because it's the apocalypse, you're gonna need trade. But what are you doing looting money? Like, that's not gonna do you any good.
Oh, yeah, I could never figure that one out either.
Well, as Peter says, you never know. Society might come back and you'll need the money. But no, the best moment I found in that, because it's so true, is when the dude picks up the like really big state of the art for the Time TV, and I think it's Savini or one of the other bikers, just goes, what are you going to watch on that? And he's like, oh, yeah, just smashes the thing because, yeah, there's no TV on. What's the plan?
agreed.
But yeah, so did you guys have anything that you picked up on in the direction that you wanted to mention? And I'll mix it up. I'll come to you this time, Nita, first.
Well, I did notice something, and maybe it's just in the extended version of it. You let me know. But what was with the sombreros on the bikers that some of the Latino bikers, like, really? Like, did you have to go there? Couldn't they just be bikers with biker helmets? Why sombreros?
Fair enough. And what about you, DK, then? Is there anything in the directing that you picked up on that we haven't mentioned?
What I do love is, even prior to the mall, I love the opening scenes where it's showing the breakdown in society. I think that's absolutely fantastic, and it gives you such a sense of tension right from the word go. At the end of Night of the Living Dead, you think everything's wrapped up, and you see that kind of viewpoint when they're flying over all the rednecks and stuff who are out.
Yeah, kind of. It almost picks up on that last scene, the way they're talking about, oh, I bet the rednecks are enjoying it, and we kind of saw that at the end of Night.
Yeah, but that opening scene in the newsroom, to me, even now, it's absolutely terrifying. You cannot watch that and not be gripped. And I think opening it with that, and he directed that so well.
Yeah. No, I agree. And there's a moment, again, it's a small moment of social satire, but I did find it quite kind of telling, where they're saying, like, who stopped the feed? And it's because they're giving the wrong information out. And so Fran kind of wants to correct it so people aren't being sent to the wrong place. And the kind of the execs, as it were, are just like, no, we need eyes on the screen at all times. And I was like, you give a shit about viewing figures and ratings at this point? Like, it's the apocalypse, dude.
Well, they would, wouldn't they? Let's be fair.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. That's my point. It's like, they can't see the woods for the trees. So they're just like, it doesn't matter if we're sending people to their death, because as long as we've got everybody with their eyes on our network or whatever. I was like, geez, is that really a priority? Okay, whatever.
Yeah.
Anyway, so yeah, what about you, Josh? Anything in the direction you wanted to mention that we haven't said?
I can't remember, Michael, if it was you or DK that said it, but the way that Romero's use of the space, it could feel so open at some points, but then in others you just feel so closed in and just, you know, like you can't get out. Because I do films too, and I love that claustrophobic feel, especially in tense situations. And I also agree with you guys. One of the things that did bug me about this, the color of the blood.
Yeah.
The color of the blood is probably my biggest gripe about the whole thing. And it's just so bright. It's so bright. The very first time I saw this movie, I was like, what? Was color kind of muted back in the 70s? So they had to amp it up to make it be seen?
It's
so bright. It almost glows in the dark.
Yeah, that's neither here nor there. But no, there's so much good stuff in the direction, I think, that we've kind of touched on already, really thematically, and the little moments as well. So I'm going to move to the acting now.
Before we move, can I just say something about that bright blood really quickly?
No.
That also, I'm doing it. That also goes. that also goes with the visual that I was talking about. And how you receive information visually, right? And if you're paying attention, you're going, what's happening? What's with that blood? And you're looking at it and you're not feeling the realism of what they're trying to do.
Yes. I was just going to say, I think this film arguably doesn't have the realism of Night of the Living Dead, which is way more kind of atmospheric, and it kind of feels like you're in there and it's kind of a real lived-in world, whereas this is more arguably like... I wouldn't say it doesn't feel real. A lot of the time it does, but then, as you said, the violence and stuff is very EC comic book, which is deliberate. So, you know, I kind of roll with it. Fair enough. So, DK, do you have anything on the acting? We've kind of talked at length, I think, about the arcs, but I'll let you...
I've got a bit. The bit in the movie where Roger slides down between the escalators was Scott Renninger's idea. Savini recalls how he and the other cast and crew members did the same thing during the film's production. They joke that you can't do that now, since all escalators have metal posts sticking up, and they believe that's because of them. The outdoor scene where the hunters, emergency crew and soldiers are shooting at zombies was done using local volunteers. Several local hunters arrived on scene with their own weapons and no doubt a few six-packs. The local National Guard division showed up in full gear, and local emergency crew, police, fire and ambulance were present all voluntarily. Extras who appeared in this film were reportedly given $1 in cash, a donut, and a Dawn of the Dead t-shirt. actors...
Oh, that's painful.
I don't know. I bet that shirt goes for quite some money on eBay.
Probably, yeah.
Zombie actors took photographs of themselves dressed up in full makeup inside the phone booth on the second floor. They then replaced the sample pictures on the front of the booth with these photos.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Some of the actors playing zombies in the movie would frequently get drunk at the late night bar called the Brown Derby, which I believe you can see in the mall during the film. One night they stole a golf cart and crashed into a marble pillar, causing $7,000 worth of damage.
Well, they figured they weren't getting paid, right?
Exactly. Joseph Pilato, who plays Captain Rhodes in Day of the Dead, which we'll look at next time, briefly appears in this film as an unnamed police officer during the scene at the police dock. It's believed by many horror fans, headcanon alert,
that the police officer is Captain Rhodes, with the backstory being that Rhodes was a Philadelphia policeman and an army reservist.
Ah, okay. Interesting. Yeah.
And finally, when Tarantino was trying to get his start in the film industry, he convinced more than a few people he had a role in this movie as the shaggy-haired, sidecar-riding, Tommy Gun-wielding biker Mousy. Tarantino wasn't in this movie at all, but his resume padding worked.
Well, there we go. So, yeah, I mean, we've talked at length, as I said, all the notes I have on the group are the stuff we've already mentioned, so I don't feel the need to really return or go over that again. But I will say, I didn't mention earlier, and we've kind of already mentioned him, that Tom Savini, who did the makeup effects, also appears as the lead biker. Arguably the weakest performance, but I think he's doing what he's told to, because it's like comedically heightened. So exactly. It is meant to be ridiculous. So you kind of, I forgive it for what it is. But yeah, it's an interesting thing that he was, I don't think he was an actor. I think he was just put in because he did the effects for this. So yeah. And as you said, I like the way the zombies move. I'm all for the kind of shambling dead body type zombies, and the threat being when they're all grouped together. And like I said, well, the whole point is they're sleepwalking to the mall anyway, isn't it? So.
Apparently that, George Romero didn't want to give them directions because he thought if he gave them directions, they'd all move as kind of a herd in one move.
Yeah.
So his direction were just act dead, and that was it.
And he was like, "Mike, you're nailing it." And I was like, "I haven't started yet." If I'd have been there, that would have been what happened. But no, so did you guys have anything you wanted to mention on the acting? I think we've kind of talked about it, really.
Yeah, I think they all give fantastic performances. Well, I mean, the main group do. There's a couple of zombies in there that I'm not too sure on. And the bikers, yeah, just give them a slap.
And the kind of comically exaggerated racist guy at the start, but that's the whole point, is he meant to be
dead and die, you know.
Oh, and shout out as well to the really, it's such a small performance, but the priest who appears when they get to the basement. And
he's really good. Yeah.
So good in that very brief role as well. So, yeah. So I'll tell you what, we'll move to the VFX production design then. And once again, DK, I'll come over to you.
Yeah. With regards to that, the thing at the start, during the raid on the tenement building early in the film, a zombie escapes from one of the apartments and then is then embraced by his wife, who immediately attacks. When the actor bites the actress's arm to tear away the blood pack effect, he accidentally bit over the pack and caught part of her arm, causing a minor but painful injury. The scream that the woman lets out is quite authentic, apparently.
Yikes.
Yeah. George Romero had wanted to hire Tom Savini to do the special effects for Night of the Living Dead, but Savini, who served as a combat photographer in the US Army, couldn't commit because he had to go on a tour in Vietnam. Fortunately, he was able to do this film, and his recent Vietnam experience played an enormous part in his visualization of the graphic gory effects, as he was basically just recreating what he'd seen in real life, although with, you know, better blood. And yeah, Tom Savini chose the gray color for the zombie skin, since Night of the Living Dead was in black and white and the zombie skin tone was not depicted. He later said it was a mistake because many of them ended up looking quite blue on camera.
Yeah, I did read that as well. And he kind of agrees it looks silly, but
yeah. Insert Tobias Funk joke here.
Yeah, so I mean, I don't have much else to add to that. Like I said, you've kind of went over a few of the things that I had. I will say, I think it's kind of ingenious to have used an actual mall. It gives you that production design that you wouldn't get if you just built one. You know, your mileage may vary with regards to that. You might think it was better to build a set, but I think it adds.
No,
that
I think really. They've done really well. They did really well using that. I'm stoked that it's still there. I would love to visit.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. There's, again, if you go on the Wikipedia page, there's a picture of the escalator, and it says this is the famous escalator that that Roger slides down. The very same. It's still there.
That slide was epic. That slide was epic. That was a moment where it couldn't have gone better if you planned it. You know, that was exactly, fantastic.
Yeah. Yeah, awesome. So, did you guys have anything about the VFX or the production design that especially stood out?
I think that Tom Savini is an amazing makeup artist, and he does a wonderful job in anything he does. But yeah, the the bluish gray skin is my second biggest complaint about this film behind the blood. But yeah, other than that, the effects were phenomenal. Especially the shotgun to the head in the beginning of the
yeah,
the film.
Starts off strong with that as soon as that happened. Oh, yeah. That's where we're going. Oh, yeah.
And especially for something that was made in the 70s, the special effects, some of them, some still kind of hold up today.
Oh yes, especially when you think it's also low budget, so it's not like they were working you know, Hollywood money either. You know, it was quite inventive, and I think there's some ingenious use of it, of you know, gory effects and stuff in there. Like I said, I don't know who thought of the idea that one of the zombies would just walk into the chopper blades and get, you know, decapitated like the top of a boiled egg. But it's just such a weird, crazy idea. And the fact that you can spot that kind of that zombie every other crowd scene because it's the one with the, you know, half a head.
Yes, exactly.
So yeah, I love all that. TK, did you have anything to add?
No, I think you've pretty much covered it all between you.
That's cool. I'll move to the music and sound then, because as I said, weirdly, the music is the biggest difference between the three different versions of the film that exist and that you can get on home media. Argento's version, as I said, has the score by Goblin, not The Goblins, which is more pulsing prog rock and adds the kind of surreal intensity to the film. The US theatrical cut has that, a little bit of that, but also library stock music, which creates the tonal dissonance that, you know, heightens the comedy and absurdity when it happens. And yeah, like I said, the can cut is almost all stock tracks, but I can't say I particularly noticed because I didn't think any of them were as egregious as the ones from Night of the Living Dead, which are very on the nose at times. So I thought it was, you know, whatever the stock music they picked must have been quite good. And other than that, I just think, yeah, using sound as satire, like little things like the elevator muzak, again, in the middle of a carnage scene, is just so bizarre. But yeah, it's amazing, like I said, the way that the different soundscapes and music can change the tone of all three versions of the film. Haven't seen the Argento version, but I'd love to see it and see if it really is way more kind of straight horror and like that. So anyway, TK, did you have anything on the music?
No, you pretty much, I mean, he was introduced to Goblin, the Italian band who did the soundtracks for a number of horror films through Argento. Since Argento had the right to change the music in Dawn of the Dead for release in foreign markets, he had the band create a soundtrack for it. George mentions he had the option to use some or all of Goblin's score if he chose to, and he uses it periodically through his version of Dawn of the Dead. One thing I did notice with regards to the soundtrack, it's been some years since I've watched this film. I told you this before, Mike. And there's a little section of stock music when Peter and Roger are going for the trucks to seal off the mall. And it's called Dank Earth by Don Harper. And the reason it sounded familiar to me, it's actually used as the intro music for as the intro for Gorilla's second album, Demon Days.
Oh, wow, okay. I felt sure you were going to say it was used in Buckaroo Banzai or something.
No, I couldn't find any freaking links this time.
Wow. Before we kind of wrap things up then, I kind of, because I presume we're going to wait and the audience feedback will be on Day of the Dead, DK, yeah?
Yes.
I did want to get into something because I find this weirdly fascinating and just wild. That because of the nature of Dawn of the Dead, with it being made separately as Zombie, as I'll call it, by Dario Argento, given that new title, sequels to this completely vary depending on which region you're in, and it is massively different. So in Italy, Dawn of the Dead, as I said, was retitled Zombie, I'll call it for sake of clarity, and was then followed by Zombie 2 and a bunch of officially released sequels made by Lucio Fulci, which, you know, carry on from there. In the UK, the series, the Zombie series, was called Zombie Flesh Eaters, and it follows the Italian series in order, but ignores Dawn of the Dead and thus starts with Zombie 2. So Zombie 2 becomes Zombie Flesh Eaters 1, Zombie 3 becomes Zombie Flesh Eaters 2, so on and so forth. This gets even worse. The German series, like the Italian, starts off with Dawn of the Dead, but ignores Fulci's Zombie 2, which was released separately as Voodoo, and instead continues with Day of the Dead, and then the Italian Zombie 3.
Jesus, it's a free-for-all.
Oh man, it gets worse. The Thai series follows the titling and numbering of the British series, but adds the unrelated film Killing Birds with the new title Zombie Flesh Eaters 4. The Australian version of the series uses Roman numerals and is composed only of sequels, most of which are retitled Italian films. However, one exclusive installment was produced titled Zombie 8 Urban Decay in 2020. The series starts with Zombie 4 Bacterian and concludes with Zombie 8 Urban Decay. Although the American series begins with Zombie 2 and continues in the established sequence, some of the films were retitled again, and titles do not follow in numerical order. Zombie 2 was renamed Zombie, but Zombie 3 was renamed Zombie 3. There is no Zombie 2. Two additional films were released on home video with titles that would imply they were sequels, which had nothing to do with the Italian series.
This is like following the plot of Primer.
Jesus.
There's more. I don't even know if I'll keep this in, but I just find it fascinating. In the 1990s, several unrelated titles were released as zombie sequels by TZ Video, aka Ed Entertainment. They were Zombie, which was Zombie 2. Zombie 2 was Zombie 3. Zombie 3 Return of the Zombies was originally a Spanish film, La Orgia de los Muertos. Zombie 4, A Virgin Among the Living Dead, was a French film, Christina Princess de l'Eroticism. Zombie 5, Revenge in the House of Usher, was a Spanish film called Revenge in the House of Usher. Zombie 6, Monster Hunter, was originally called Absurd and is actually a pseudo-sequel to Joe D'Amato's Anthropophagus. And Zombie 7 was originally titled The Grim Reaper. So, yeah. And that's all I have, I promise. But yeah.
Wow.
So,
you sure you don't want more time to give us some more zombie movies? You didn't go to the Argentinian zombies.
It's just so weird that depending on which country you're in, there's a completely different series, and some of these Romero ones are in, sometimes they aren't. Some of the Fulci ones are, but aren't at other times. And the fact that the American one just doesn't bother with Zombie 2 so that it can carry on with the numbering from the Italian series, so it skips that entirely.
You know, we got to do our own thing, okay? Yeah, we are exactly. Rebels to the end.
We have to be different with it.
Yeah.
Can you just imagine?
We don't want to follow the sequences of numbers, okay?
A zombie convention, an international zombie convention, and there's a group stood around saying, oh, you know, did you see Zombie 2? And they've just all seen completely the different movie. I mean, upstairs are flying because nobody understands what's going on.
Exactly. True though. Yeah, I just find that almost hilarious, but so anyway, with that out of the way, we'll move to giving our thoughts, beginning with, as I tend to do in the things that I host, our favorite character moment and line in the movie. And Nita, I'm gonna come to you first, why not? So we'll start with, who's your favorite character?
I don't know, I'm torn right between the female character. Oh, and I really, 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 I know he dies and he's kind of rough. What's it? Roger, I believe it's
Roger.
Yeah. I actually really liked his character a lot. So I really enjoyed those two characters, but there isn't a better line than "there's no room in hell."
Mm, cool. And do you have a favorite moment or a favorite scene that stands out for you?
I think that moment where he dies, and I know it's kind of sad, but it kind of brings him closure, and it brings us understanding of who he was, because you don't get that too much in the beginning. And you see this rough, skilled, kind of tough guy that goes, if you look at him in the street, you would not expect the level of skill set that he has to survive when looking at him, just to look at him. But he demonstrates that. I think that his death was sadly beautiful and necessary for the film. I think it gave the film this beauty that you don't truly get from zombie films.
Yeah. I mean, I know it's become a cliche now, but I did appreciate that he basically tells Peter, you know, if I do turn, finish me off. But then the fact that he's still so cocky as to be like, but don't do it until you're sure I'm coming back, because I'm going to try not to. Like, he's going to be the one person.
Yes, he's going to be the one person. Yeah. You have to admire the resilience that he wants to fight even when he no longer has fight.
Yeah, exactly.
I can respect that.
I'm going to move on to you then, Josh. Do you have a favorite character, first of all, in the movie?
I like Fran, but my favorite character has to be Peter. I just love the way that Ken Foray portrayed that character and just the arc that he got throughout this film, and just his line of "There's no more room in hell." I agree with everybody else on that. That's one of the best lines in film history.
Yeah, for sure. And do you have a favorite moment or scene that stood out for you?
Honestly, it's for me. I don't know why, but I like how they tried to become very domestic in this mall.
Yeah.
While the apocalypse was going on around them, they're just continuing on like there's nothing. Just like there's nothing wrong.
Like they're sitting down for dinner.
Yeah, exactly. For some reason, I don't know why, but I love that aspect of this film that you know the world is literally crumbled around them. And they're just sitting there having dinner and goofing off like yeah, it's fine. It's fine. Everybody else is dying and the world is collapsing, but here we are living in a mall.
Exactly. Yeah. Cool. So what about you, DK? Favorite character, first of all?
Roger, obviously.
Roger. Yeah, you did say that. Yeah. That's fair enough. Roger that. And what was your favorite moment or scene?
The opener. The opening scene.
The opening scene. Yeah. That makes sense. And do you have a favorite line?
It's the same as everybody else's. You can't really get a better line than that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that's fair enough.
I'm hard-pressed to challenge anyone to show us a better line than that.
Oh, 100%. 100%.
I say bring it to the comments. Tell me what you think.
So, I'll not give you anything unique, unfortunately, because my favorite character, I do like all of them and I like the arcs they all go on, but my favorite character was Peter. I have to agree with you, Josh, because I can't emphasize enough how forward thinking it was to once again have a black man who's arguably the lead who takes charge.
Most definitely.
Not questioned, you know what I mean? Nobody questions his skill set or his competence, and he comes across, you know, quite charming, quite together, and you can understand why the people would follow him and do as he's told. And again, it's nice that he survives kind of at the end. So, yeah. My favorite scene, just because I love the satirical edge of it, is the scene where they realize kind of where they are and they just go on a montage of just doing stuff in the mall.
Yeah.
Just going to the various shops. And I have to say, I under favorite line, I actually have two, because I want to give you the full version of the one you've all given, which is great. But I have to say, I did just bust out laughing at Peter going like, "It's a crime. The only man who could shoot, who could miss with this gun, is the sucker with the bread to afford it." Which I think is, oh boy, that made me laugh. But no, my favorite line was definitely, "They're after us. They know we're still in here. They're after the place. They don't know why. They just remember that they want to be in here. What the hell are they? They're us. That's all. There's no more room in hell." So, that was the one I appreciated, because it speaks to the allegory. And then, as you said, it does go to there's no more room in hell. Dead will walk the earth line immediately afterwards. So, yeah, cool. So we'll finish up, as we always do, with our conclusion, if we have one, and our score out of 5 stars. Nita, did you want to go first for this?
Yes. Okay, so I'm going to go with a 4.
Okay.
Absolutely a 4-star for this. You know, I like this movie, but I'm not in love with the movie. And I think there's a few elements there that could have been different. I think that they worked for the times. I think that they were appropriate for the times, but I'm still going to give it a 4.
Yeah, 4's still good. That's fair enough. Yeah. Josh, did you want to go next, or would you rather us do it so give you time to gather your thoughts?
No, I can go. It's for me, it's also a 4. The writing is great. Romero's direction is great. The acting is great. The only reason that I'm not gonna give it a 4.5 or a 5 is the pie fight. That's a big one. And some of the makeup is rather dated, like the blood and the blue skin. Those are the only reasons that I really wouldn't give it a 4.5 or a 5. Okay. But other than those things, it's a phenomenal film, and it's one of my favorites, and one that I recommend to anybody that likes zombies if they haven't seen it. Mm. And if you haven't seen it and you like zombies, then you're not a true zombie fan.
Yeah, exactly. And I have to say, even if you've seen the Zack Snyder version, it is such a different movie that should watch this, because it's they're nothing alike. Other than the mall setting, they have nothing in common. So don't think you've seen it if you've seen the quote-unquote remake either. DK, what about you then?
I do like this one. It starts off really tense. I love it. Yes, it's very dated now, but, it's to be expected, set from the 70s. I think all the performances are really good in the main character. I think I can kind of look past the makeup effects as being a product of their time, so I'm not too bothered about that. I think it's a tense film, and it's really well plotted until the bikers, and that's where it kind of goes off the rails a little for me. I told you this the other night. It's going to be a 4 from me.
Okay. That's going to be a 4 from GK as well. And there are 4 of us here, I believe. So, as I do my calculations, I, as usual, have a pre-prepared statement. So, sorry if it sounds a little stupid. My conclusion is as follows. Dawn of the Dead says and does a lot, arguably more than it often gets credit for. Night of the Living Dead may have created the modern zombie, but Dawn showed what you could truly do with it. Here, the undead become a vehicle for exploring human failings. Our relentless capitalist urge to consume, our willingness to turn on each other, and our inability to resist our worst instincts. The zombies are terrifying, yes, but they're also just one obstacle in a world where the real enemy is mankind itself. The monsters are us, and we are the real monsters. Another groundbreaking and now much imitated concept. If Night hinted at these societal themes, Dawn cements them. Much like Alien to Aliens, it's a less atmospheric horror film, but also a sequel that refuses to be a retread. Its satire and social commentary are sharper, its characters more fleshed out, and their fates more devastating as a result. The film introduced the now standard idea that a bite means inevitable doom, making every encounter more harrowing. Watching these people who feel so real struggle and fall makes the tragedy hit all the harder, even as the story reminds us of the futility of trying to build a normal life in an apocalypse. Having now watched the extended can cut, I understand why Romero trimmed it. The pacing lingers and the wait for chaos is a bit long, but the added character beats are a real bonus for fans and deepen the humanity at the heart of the story, making it a worthwhile addition, if not replacement. For me, Dawn of the Dead is Romero's masterpiece, a perfect balance of horror and satire, allegory and humanity. It drags the terror into a disturbingly familiar reality and in doing so, set the gold standard for the zombie genre. Hugely influential and endlessly watchable, it's not just one of the greatest horror films ever made, it's a serious contender for the best sequel of all time. And I correctly gave it 5 out of 5. You are all
that's how you're gonna throw down today. Okay. Brooklyn on you, you get a little bit
old,
you know?
Oh no, there's no more room in Brooklyn.
There's no more room in Brooklyn. Don't mess with Brooklyn zombies, okay?
But no, in all fairness, that's still a pretty great score. So combining it, adding the scores together, dividing by the 4 of us here, gives you a final score for Dawn of the Dead of 4.25 out of 5, exactly, which not too shabby. I think you can't really complain about
not
that.
At all.
So,
no, not yeah. at all.
Great. And so the mall lights dim and the undead shuffle off screen. And once again, I have to thank our amazing guests. Thank you, Josh, for coming on for the first time. Did you have a good time?
Yeah.
Oh, I had a great time. I had a great time.
Awesome. And do you have anywhere people can find you online or anything you wanted to plug?
You can just find me on Facebook under Joshua Merkley, and anybody can add me. So
cool. I'll get that up, DK, and pop it in the episode description as well. That's cool.
Yeah, definitely.
Are you joining us again next week for Day of the Dead?
I would love to.
Awesome. Fantastic. So we'll have the full house again next week to finish the trilogy. Nita, you know what I'm going to ask you. Have you had a good time?
Oh, it was fantastic. As always, love hanging out with you guys. It was great. And I love talking about zombies. So, yeah.
And this is where I'm going to let you, despite your bad scoring, plug your podcast. Go on.
Okay. Yes, you can find me in Sci-Fi Queens and any pretty much all social media platforms under Sci-Fi Queens. Our next episode, we're going to continue with celebrating Hispanic Heritage Month. And we're going to be interviewing on September 26th at 9 p.m. Eastern Time. I have 4 favorite indie comic book authors, and I have the privilege of interviewing John Avina from Avina Comics. He does amazing sci-fi comics with Mexican beautiful lore. He has other genres in his repertoire. Definitely check him out. He's incredible. We're going to talk to him. It's going to be an hour of John Abina. And I'm very excited to speak to him on September 26th, 9 p.m. Eastern time.
That's awesome. Well, that will have already that will have already went out by the time this airs, but you can definitely go back and watch that, you know, on replay, yeah, as it were, so for sure.
That's right. Awesome.
And DK, thanks as always for having my back in this podcast bunker.
No problem, dude. Been a pleasure as always. Looking forward to next week. And I believe, I mean, I know it's Josh's first time, but I believe it's Nita's first time on Cult Classics, isn't it?
Mm-mm. No.
Isn't it? You've been on the Cult Classics show before?
I think you're right. It would be my first time on the Cult Classic. Listen, I'm always with you guys on some kind of podcast. I'm kind of like having difficulty separating them. I'm with my brothers. It's all good. I'm with my brothers.
I'm hanging with you guys all the time. They all kind of merge into one.
I'm so tired of these two guys. So tired of these two.
Bless. But yeah, you can find all of our social media links through the link tree in the episode description or the on-screen graphic shown during our YouTube outro. Please do like, comment, share, and spread the gory goodness. Come join the spooky fun before it's too late. Yeah, as DK mentioned, we're going to fast forward 7 years, head to Florida, and do our best to avoid scientists and soldiers, because next week we're handing to DK's Cult Classics to round out this trilogy of terror. We'll be back once more, and this time, well, let's just say the apocalypse has well and truly arrived. So, yeah, join us for that. And until then, remember, board the windows, check the exits, and keep an eye on the escalators. Good night out there.
You have been listening to the Silver Screen Podcast, hosted by Mike Wilson and DK. Behind the Scenes section by DK. Additional material by Mike Wilson. Follow us on social media, our YouTube channel, or wherever you get your podcasts. Link to all of these places can be found via the link tree listed in this episode's description. This podcast is a Media Matters original production, created, produced, and edited by Mike Wilson. We'd love it if you'd like, subscribe, and share us around like a beloved old video cassette. We hope to see you next time for more movie magic. Until then, remember, life moves pretty fast, so stop and watch a movie now and then.